jazz.
Busted.
Anyway, let's do a podcast. All you know right. I got a question about one of the ones we're doing, because one of the four I really don't like, and I don't have a reason why.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to explore that reason on Jazz Bastard Podcast 238. I'm Pat.
Mike.
And as usual, we're doing four albums, and we're going to get to those albums, but there is an emergency. And that emergency is Elvin Jones was in a homoerotic Western as a mentor figure, and no one told me this. Holy crap. Zachariah.
I have not seen it yet, by the way.
Because I'm kind of counting on you as the cineast among the two of us to tell me all about this film.
What you're looking for is cineast, but keep going.
Okay. I guess you just proved my point, sucker. Yeah, whatever, dude, movie lover. Yeah, I was the BBC website, which seems largely written for children, but there's a little tab called culture. And the tab reminds me of like very earnest college essays about cultural studies topics blown out to like three times the length and actually proofread. I mean, they're coherent. They're just very earnest and they go on. But one of these was about this Western Zachariah, and there's a photograph of the two leads and this black cowboy. And I'm like, man, you know, that guy looks kind of like Elvin Jones. That's weird, you know. I hope it's not racist to me to think that, you know, or something, you know, and it was fucking Elvin Jones. I'm like, Elvin Jones was in a Western. Elvin Jones, the greatest, one of the greatest drummers of jazz, appeared as a cowboy mentor to these cowboy dudes.
How do I want to put it? I'll put it this way. One of the leads looks an awful lot like Simon Le Bon of what's the name of the band? Help me out.
God damn it. I know exactly who you mean, but I can't.
Duran Duran.
Thank you.
Yeah, just like, and it turns out it's Don Johnson.
It's Don Johnson, yes, who apparently was a huge, you know, just a luscious, young, dewy Don Johnson. Apparently the gay community at that time was really into him, and he appreciated it. I don't think he was himself gay, but he appreciated that audience followed him. And, yeah, I wouldn't have realized it was him. It was just so, I mean, I don't think of him being that old Miami Vice, but he was a grown man then. This is a very young Don Johnson. So what a bizarre. And apparently the script was written in part by the Fire Sign Theater guys. Anyway.
Well, I mean, so the article makes the point, and it's a very smart point, and it's actually very accurate. This is all post Power of the Dog, right? Since Power of the Dog is the recent 2021 film with Benedict Cumberbatch, which teases questions of homosociality and homosexuality in the Old West, yes?
Right.
And this article basically says, guess what? That's been around for a long time. And it name checks the very freaky film El Topo, but then other things like this movie you're talking about, Zachariah, as well as The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which is, you know, a kind of slow burn festival of understated or just not really well camouflaged homosexual cliches all the way through that film. You know, a lot of the weird Westerns of the late 60s, early 70s, you know, traded in these cliches and traded in these issues of complex masculinity, even if they weren't overt about it. You made me want to see Zachariah because, yes, I would watch any movie with Elvin Jones with guns. You had me at Elvin Jones and guns.
Yeah, I feel like in high school they should teach you about Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, and then Elvin Jones was in this homoerotic Western. That should be the third thing you get in history class.
Teach you about George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and just Elvin Jones, period.
That would help too.
Elvin Jones should be like the third member on the things of everyone should know something about.
Absolutely. American history. Great drummer. But yeah, anyway. So I'm still trying to process that. Also, yeah. Had a dramatic week in that about a week and a half ago, one of the cats disappeared for a day and a half. I was convinced she was dead. I mean, regular as clockwork, and it was cold night. Not the kind of cat that wants to be out in the cold for long. Where they went, we don't know.
Did they return?
But she came back. Yep, she did. Slept all day long, you know, got up and eat, go back to sleep, clearly worn out. Whether she was trapped in a garage or somebody let her in, didn't let her out, we just don't know. She won't tell.
has another family. You don't know about it.
Yeah. Well, this is, she just developed it because first time she'd ever been gone more than a couple hours. So
hours have, one in particular, shows increasing interest in the door. Not that there's anything, like, she just would like to get into the hallway. And then if she got into the hallway, she'd be traumatized, but she thinks it would be a great place to get to. So when we come in, we always have to, you know, be ready to kick a cat into play because she's waiting. And if you're too busy with packaging or something, she will make a run for it. So that's a new development in our world.
We all need goals. And our goal tonight is to talk about 4 jazz albums. A little transition going on there. I picked a couple vocal albums. One, just an album I'm fond of from back in the day, a $3 beat-up LP I picked up early in my LP adventure. Maxine Sullivan's Close as Pages in a Book from 1969 on Monmouth Evergreen. And then Samara Joy's debut self-titled album on Whirlwind from 2021. Samara Joy has been getting a lot of great write-ups. She won the Sarah Vaughan competition a couple years back and is a coming name in jazz vocals, so I thought it was worth discussing her stuff. And then you picked a couple.
Yeah, these are just both things that we get as review copies, and I've been working my way in reverse order through the things that I sort of fell asleep on back in 2021. So I'm actually caught up, or mostly caught up, to 2022 at this point, or getting close. But yeah, these came out in 2021, and I had finally listened to them, and I'm like, hey, let's talk about them, because I thought they were both interesting. So one is Dave Young's Mantra. Dave Young is an octogenarian bassist from Canada, and we'll say more about him when we get to his album Mantra. And then an Israeli saxophonist who's based in Brooklyn, isn't everyone, I guess he's from Tel Aviv originally, named Asaf Uria, his album Exorcisms. So those are our other two albums this week.
Yep, they're both from 2021. Exorcisms is on JoJo Records. Mantra is on Modica Music. You want to start with the horns or with the singers?
I don't care. Oh my gosh, sorry. That was a yawn. A really robust yawn just escaped me. Forgive me. Forgive me, listeners. I'm very interested in this week's music. It's just
all right.
I went for a run earlier and my body is reminding me that I'm not as young as I used to be. So anyway.
Filling in nap time. Okay, well let's start with
Daisy. Let's start with the vocalist because I got a question.
All right.
Sorry,
okay.
I got questions.
All right. Maybe I can't live to love you as long as I want to. Life isn't long enough, baby, but I can love you as long as I live. Maybe I can't give you diamonds and things like I want. But I can promise you, baby, I'm gonna want to as long as I live.
Let's just start with Maxine Sullivan's Closest Pages in a Book. I know that's the one you did not like or not. 1969, Bob Wilbur, the clarinetist and saxophone player, is kind of the musical director on this. George, I can't even say it. You say his name. The great French bassist, George Duvivier, maybe?
Duvivier? Sounds right.
Gus Johnson Jr. I'm more confident with Gus on drums. And Bernie Lighton on piano. So a quartet backing Maxine Sullivan. Maxine was a swing-era vocalist born in 1911 who had a bizarre little hit with a jazz version of Loch Lomond.
Right.
Arranged by Gil Evans' mentor, Claude Thornhill. And that was her big hit. And then she did other swinging versions of folk songs and did other songs and then retired for a while and then came back to music. And this is, what I think, probably the first album-length feature that she'd done for a while. I don't know. Is this the one you don't like? I kind of like this record. I find it charming.
No, I know you love this. And no, this isn't the one that I have questions about. The only question I have about this is why do you – so I like this. But why do you love this so much? I mean, when you proposed we do this, I remember – I think you had hooked me up with this ages ago, and I thought that your enthusiasm for it was so large that in my mind, retrospectively, I thought we had already done a podcast on it. And so when you said, let's put it in the next podcast, I was like, didn't we do that already? I thought I've already heard you wax eloquent about this, but
I double checked. I don't think we have. I don't see it on the spreadsheet.
No, it's fine. I trust your record keeping. So if you haven't waxed eloquent for others, you certainly have waxed eloquent for me. So share with others what you've shared with me about why you like this so much. And then I like it too. So I'll say what I think.
I'm completely hairless now after all that waxing. Yeah. I guess I would never claim this is some kind of stunning classic. I never claim that Maxine Sullivan is one of the great vocalists of all time. She is not. For me, what sums up this record is charm. Not greatness, not brilliance, but just it's a delightful, modest little record. She is, she's got a decent voice. Gets a little pitchy on Lock Them On, but maybe that's just sheer exhaustion with dealing with that song.
Right.
Which, she's very open. Her liner notes, she has little liner notes for some of these songs, and they're just very direct. And, this is what happened here. She seems like just a very direct, down-to-earth person. And I don't know why people like this song, but they always wanted me to sing it kind of thing. I think it was fascinating to me because it was something I'd never heard of and ran across it probably like in a secondhand books bin or something for like $3. And I thought, maybe I'm going to like this. And the reason is I do like Bob Wilbur.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, this is 69. When does Bitches Brew come out? Is it 69 or 70? It's like, it's so easy for us to turn jazz into a linear story of this style and that style and this thing and this moment, and to watch the biggest figures of it going, through those progressions. And this has nothing the fuck to do with anything going on in 1969. It is completely just this bizarre little project that this tiny label puts together, and which I think, my version of it's kind of beaten up. It sounds great. I mean, I like the sound of it. And they just cover some old-fashioned songs. I mean, closest pages in a book.
We'll be close as pages in a book, my love and I. So close, we can share a single look, share every sign. So close that before I hear your laugh, my laugh breaks through.
Had you ever heard of that song before?
No.
I mean, it's not, I don't think it's a bad song. It's cute or, I don't know, again, quaint, maybe. I just absolutely, what the fuck is that song? Where did it come from? So there is also that sense of it's not let's go back to the swing era and relive it. It's odder than that. It's like some of these songs, again, I mean, Lock Lamont itself is odd. Too Many Tears, Restless. Yeah. Some of these songs are just, and then, she does a great vocalese version of Rockin' in Rhythm.
Yep.
Just, and again, she's not, it's not fireworks or anything. She's just kind of singing the melody in this very straightforward, almost joyful way, blah, blah, blah. And Bob's there, and I think Bob is a very gifted reed player who thought, Sidney Bechet and Johnny Hodges were fucking great. He never saw a modal tune in his life. That is not his, he is very firmly ensconced in 30s jazz, and it's what he loves, and he's just really fucking good at it. He's like 20 years younger than Maxine, maybe. So, yeah, I would never want to say that this is some kind of towering masterpiece, but it is like you went down Diagon Alley, or however they say it in Harry Potter. It's like you're going along with what's going on in jazz, and then all of a sudden, you get pulled down this alleyway. It's like, well, what the hell is this? And I do think in its own modest terms, it works very well, and I think they made a lot of smart decisions about how it was arranged, the song selection, this recording of it, the engineering, and I don't know that I ever need or want another Maxine Sullivan album, but as a souvenir of this kind of this lady who is a fine vocalist, a little bit of a footnote to the swing era, I just think it's cool. And it's just something very different from another Blue Note or another Miles Davis album or, Weather Report. It's his own thing. Anyway, that's my rant about why I think it's worth listening to.
Yeah, I like it as well. And I think the things that stand out for me here are especially Bob Wilbur. He's all kinds of, he's a great swinging reed player. I mean, he is absolutely terrific. And he's got a little more play in the horn than Maxine does in the voice. But they share something. The way both of them swing, it's like they're just a fraction behind the beat. It's not a big, it's not Frank Sinatra. It's not
Dexter Gordon.
You know, it's just, right. It's just a little, which to me is like actually super hip to kind of have that rhythmic sense of timing to be just a little off the beat. I think is actually harder than to be, you know, way in front or way behind. It's subtler and you know, to me this reeks of you talked about it being kind of plain or straightforward and charming. I'm going to argue that it's that, but I'm going to say also that it's there's a kind of deep sophistication here in what Wilbur and Sullivan are getting up to, in the sense that this is definitely kind of a connoisseur's record. This is for people who love their swing and know their swing. And I think for listeners who are kind of steeped in that idiom, this is going to seem like a kind of subtle and classy and quiet masterclass in what makes swing so definitively interesting. I think it's subtle, and I think it's
right.
Sophisticated. It's not flashy, but it's deliberately not flashy. Like, that's a choice. I mean, Wilbur can tear it up if he wants to, and he's clearly, you know, he's playing within this particular idiom. The little fills and little plays that he does are all within this, you know, swing voice. So there's a kind of, you know, restraint and control about that, which bespeaks a lot of thought, you know, went into this. But it doesn't feel thought out. It doesn't feel like, you know, there was immense amounts of, you know, John Coltrane-esque concentration. It feels like they just kind of tossed it off. And you have to be so good to
right.
do that.
And the notes claim like three or four of the songs were first takes. So
I believe
it. This was not a, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she and he seem deeply simpatico. Like, they are, you know, and hence the title is actually quite accurate, you know. I mean, they are closest pages in a book. They are on the same page when it comes to what they're trying to do, you know, musically. And it's a great meeting of minds. I don't know if they made more albums or they, you know, revisited this format, but it's just absolutely a twinkling, sparkling example of what two people who are in a similar headspace can do when they're both really good at what they do and kind of approach the material in a similar way. This is just, you know, this is very, I think the word you used was charming a couple of times, and I think that's a good word for this. I like this, but it's not up in your face, look at our artistry. But then when you put on the headphones and you listen and you kind of really bear down, it's like, this is really, really well crafted. This is not something that two people just, you know, showed up and faked their way through. Like, they're good at this. There's a lot of skill involved here. But it doesn't feel, what's the Italian word? Sprezzatura, right? It's like, you know,
right.
It's like
the seeming art, effortlessness.
Yeah, the art of seeming effortless. Like, there was a lot of effort that went into this, but it doesn't seem effortful. Like, you know, when you listen to, like, I used Coltrane, that's a good example. Coltrane's playing sounds effortful. He sounds like someone who's been woodshedding his entire life to reach, you know, the heavens. This sounds like two people just kind of showed up late at night with some scotch and said, hey, let's make a record, you know?
Yeah.
you know, they didn't, but, you
but know. They had really good taste, you know?
Yeah,
really,
they had really good taste. And
yeah, they were just really songs. Hip, yeah.
Yeah. I love the her scatting on Rockin' and Rhythm. Again, very subtle. And other songs on here, I mean, I love. This is one of the few accounts of Darn That Dream that I enjoy.
say you love me and you hold me.
Yeah, especially after the birth of the cool version. It's like, oh, God.
And Harlem Butterfly, I think, is lovely.
Another upscale. Have you ever heard that one before? I think
I have. Isn't that an Ellington tune?
I don't know. I mean, again, it was just one of those things that they're really showing off their connoisseurship by coming up with these songs that, I mean, like Closest Pages in a Book, it's at least a sturdily put together tune. It's not a piece of crap, but no one's ever fucking heard of it. You know, it's not one of the few dozen standards from that era that everybody knows and everybody plays. And she does a few of those. But it's like, who even knows about this stuff, you know?
If it's not an Ellington song, he should have written a song called Harlem Butterfly.
Yeah, it sounds like
it. Sounded like this, you know? And I, you know, I love Loch Lomond. I mean, what a stupid song. And yet that... That treatment is wonderful, especially, you know, St. Patrick's Day. Well, you know, we're going to be hearing that tune, you know, in the culture. But this is it's really terrific take on that song. So, and I'm surprised. I didn't know that was her hit. How bizarre. Anyway, yeah, I like this album a lot, and I'm glad.
Mercer. Okay, so Johnny Mercer, I guess, wrote Harlem Butterfly.
Ah, okay.
I'm pulling out the little gatefold thing here. It's cool. Anyway. Yeah, clearly a hobbyist production. This label was just somebody I assume that inherited money or something, or made money and wanted to spend it on making these records. You know, it was not commercial imperative was not in play here particularly. You know, that's what everyone's want. Maxine Sullivan and Bob Wilbur. It's 1969. Come on, hippies, let's go.
Right.
Yeah. A neat little album, and I think it's out there either streaming or CD or whatever. But and boy, Bob Wilbur's clarinet tone. He really gets a richness there. You know, he's not Benny Goodman-ing it up and down the scales and going real fast, but the sound he gets, because he's also an excellent soprano saxophone player. And
yes, he is.
To do both of those at that level is unusual. You know, like Art Pepper will play clarinet, and I love it. I love it, but it's rough and ready, right? You know, he's Art playing clarinet, just like, you know, when Lester Young does, you know, it's delightful, but it's not that accomplished round woody sound. All right, well, a left field thing. I don't think it was ever that well publicized, but it's a delightful little record if you have any feeling at all for swing.
I make a date for golf, and you can bet your life it rains. Try to give a party, and the guy upstairs complains. Guess I'll go through life just catching colds and missing trains. Everything happens to me.
Okay, so now, you know, I think I'm going to call this podcast Dead Center of the Mainstream. This is a fucking mainstream group of albums. You know, they're really...
It is.
What's the mainstream? This is the mainstream. We are right here in the middle. So, Samara Joy, I just kind of, you know, that was a review copy that passed her desks, and I listened to it, and it was fine. And then I just realized, you know, she's really getting a lot of buzz. She's been well-reviewed in a lot of places, and she's an up-and-comer, and, you know, we should take a look and listen to this and talk about it a bit. This is another fairly minimalist vocal album. You know, she does not have strings. She doesn't have a big band. What she has is a trio, Pascal Grasso on guitar, and all over the guitar.
Yeah.
The guitar now has a restraining order on him. Ari Rowland on bass and Kenny Washington on drums. So just a trio there with her, and she is singing some very mainstream classics. I mean,
right down the middle. Yep.
Oh my. Except the couple of slightly odd ones I've got mixed feelings about. I have never been fond of the song Jim. I am still not fond of the song Jim. So Samara, what do you think of this one?
So I had such trouble when you said you wanted to do this. This had gone through, you know, I had listened to it when it arrived as a review copy, and I'd kind of cycled through it, you know, and I remembered being glad to be done with it. And then you said, let's do it for the podcast. And I was like, oh, like my heart sank a little bit. I've been trying to put my finger on what I don't like. It's not that, Samara Joy has, I like her, especially when she gets in her lower range. I like the tone of her voice, but there's something about her voice I'm not connecting. It's not that she's not a great singer. It's just, you know, sometimes you hear great players and they leave you cold, or great performers and you don't connect with them. And I do not connect to this vocalist, and I've tried and tried, and I've listened to this album now, I don't know, 5 or 6 times through in the last 2 weeks. And I had listened to it before that over the course of several months, about 10 times through. So I've tried. I mean, I've really, really made the effort. And I think she's a...
You're trying to say it's not you, it's her. Okay. I tried to make this work, baby.
I think she's a fine singer, but there's something about it that bugs me. Maybe it's the way she glides between notes sometimes feels kind of ooh, yeah. You know, I don't know. I feel guilty because everyone else loves this and I don't. I don't hate it. I don't think it's terrible, but I don't like it that much. You know, I appreciate her artistry. I could have done with a lot less of the guitar, maybe, but I never warmed to this, not once. And, you know, the song that maybe I warmed to the most was Jim.
Oh.
Jim doesn't ever bring me pretty flowers. He never tries to cheer my lonely hours. Don't know why I'm so crazy for Jim. He never tells me that I'm his heart's desire. I never seem to set his love afire. Gone are the years I've wasted on him.
Because I do like her when she has a kind of burnished lower tone that I really, that's, I like her in those moments. But like in her, in the higher notes, like Stardust is a song that I also basically just hate. I don't like the song Stardust anyway. Oh, and, terrible. And you know, that, I hate that. And even her lovely voice can't make me like this song. And then we get Everything Happens to Me. And I don't know what to say. She's got a great voice. I don't warm to this album though. And I feel guilty about that. I feel like if someone's really good at what they do, you know, I should like it. And she's good at what she does, but I don't care for it very much. Just for whatever reason, I don't connect to this vocalist. And I've tried. I'll try again on, you know, future albums, you know, and I won't stop trying. But yeah, I think what you said initially is kind of right. It's not her. It's me. You know, there's something about this voice that for me, it doesn't, I just don't warm to it. I don't know why. And, you know, Maxine Sullivan, you know, when I initially listened to her, I was like, there's nothing going on here. And then the more I listened to it, the more I liked it. And then I kind of warmed up to it. And the more I listened to Samara, I haven't had that experience. And again, I don't think, maybe you'll know better, but I don't think there's any intonation or pitch problems here. I think she's a fine stylist. This just doesn't, I don't connect to this. I don't know why. And like I said, I feel bad because I feel like I'm supposed to like this. I don't have any objective reasons for not liking it, but I don't like it that much. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm
sorry.
It's okay. I don't know. I didn't necessarily pick it because I was a huge fan of it as much as it seemed worth talking about because it was drawing a lot of attention. I think technically it's interesting in that the download I've had some difficulty. Every now and then it distorts a bit for me. I burned it to a DVD and put it in my tank, and it did sound better then. And I think tonight, cranking that up on the tank was the best I've liked it so far. But, I mean, one of the things we're dealing with is she is singing a repertoire of songs, a lot of which are about troubled relationships, complicated love situations, and she's 21.
I don't have a problem with the age. I don't feel like the emotion that is coming across. Maybe that's it.
My point,
emotion. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Exactly.
Sorry.
In other words, she has not lived these experiences. She's singing about them, but she hasn't really, and she says this in interviews. I mean, she seems very straightforward, seems like a nice person, you know, that she's having to imagine her way into these scenarios because, you know, at 21, few of us have lived through all the various situations described in these songs. And so that, I think, may be part of it. I mean, she is very... I was looking through the reviews. I mean, almost all of them mention that the guitarist is a busy boy.
And yeah.
I do think the difference between Bob Wilbur and you know, you have one. You know what I'm saying? Bob is like, he's a fucking blue ribbon accompanist who, like, he's mastered this fucking shit. He knows exactly what to play. Not too much, not too little. He's into it. You know, he doesn't sound like a hired gun or something. You get the feeling he loves Maxine Sullivan at some level. I mean, not romantically, but just, you know, he loves and cherishes her as an artist and as somebody who symbolizes an era that he cares about, blah, blah, blah. This guy is just a little bit busy beaver. You know, he's kind of like, take it easy.
Meeting you was a happy accident. Out of nowhere you came. One kiss and I was aflame. Have you got eyes?
You know, in this situation with a vocalist, maybe on your own with a trio, to be honest, but certainly this one, we need fewer notes. It just doesn't, especially because she is very plain spoken, straightforward. What are some of the edges? I've had a couple. Straightforward was one. Grounded, I've heard mentioned. You know, a lot of these reviews, I think poised is a great one. She's very poised.
Yeah.
She never sounds like she's getting swept up in what she's singing about. She's sounding completely in control. I mean, I think the Sarah Vaughan, apparently Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald, very good lodestars, you know. Needless to say, are her biggest models. They're the ones she cites the most. And, you know, Vaughn is that, she's got that rich timber. It's not quite as overflowingly chocolatey as Vaughn's, but, you know, it's that deeper sound, and it is a very round and firm sound and controlled sound, and I think the intonation's good and everything. And then Vaughn also sometimes doesn't sound that connected to the material. The difference being is that she is singing in a much plainer, direct style like a Maxine Sullivan, rather than Vaughn's pyrotechnics. I'm not sure. I mean, it may well be that Samara can maybe not duplicate Vaughn, but do more of that stuff. She's just choosing not to. But if you're not doing that kind of stuff, then the focus becomes, well, are you selling me the story? Are you selling me the feeling? And yeah, all this to me seems a little bit behind glass, you know. And less so, as I said, the more I've listened to it, I think I've warmed up to her a little bit. I'm hearing a little bit more. The nuance is very nuanced. You know, the gestures are very slight. But I think there's a combination of she's a bit of a minimalist and a little plain spoken. She's doing absolutely, I mean, she's not telling you a single fucking thing with her song selection, right? I mean, it's a grab bag of female vocalist standards. I mean, there's nothing idiosyncratic. You know, as again, to go back closest pages in a book, that fucking title track, who the fuck's heard of that? You know, you gotta be some kind of scholar of the era to have come up with that sucker. It's like, oh man, you beat me. You came, you know, and two or three of those songs, it's like, okay, this is the connoisseur, as you said. You know, these are for people that really know their shit about this era, really cared about it, really researched it. They know the nooks and crannies. It's not the obvious stuff. We're not doing fucking String of Pearls here, right? And Samara's track list is literally just, okay, this is like jazz vocal 101 in you know, out of the 40 songs they gave you for that class, these are 12 of them. You know, there's nothing to tell you this is what. And she, you know, I've read a couple of interviews, read some reviews, and I think all of them are very positive, as they should be. I mean, she's got a huge amount of promise, huge technique.
Oh yeah.
And she's, I feel like there's some things that she could be doing wrong that would drive me up a fucking tree that she's not. Ultimately, I think, yeah, a singer needs to reach you emotionally, reach me emotionally at least, as a listener, for me to invest very deeply in them at some level. It might be the thrill, the emotion of their technical excellence. It may not be that I feel that they're feeling the emotion the song's about, but it's got to be some kind of grab you moment. I don't think she's there yet, but she's got the possibility to be there. Yeah.
Compared to another female vocalist who we listened to several times, you know, early in her career, I mean, she's still relatively early in her career, Cécile McLaurin-Savant, like, she is idiosyncratic, and she's got, like, all the chops, but she's, like, you know, she's telling you a story about herself.
And you know how she leads off her latest album, you know, what she's covering on her latest album? First song, Wuthering Fucking Heights by Kate Bush. I'm sending you that soon. I haven't dubbed it quite yet. It just came in the mail, but we've got to talk about that. Maybe in the Pop Matter segment, but Cecile's got a new album out, and it's cray-cray, and I love it. You know, I mean, I don't know if I like it or hate it, but yeah,
but you know,
no question.
She has a point of view, like, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like, for me, you know, Cecile is like all, like, the sass is turned up to 11 on every song, you know? And there's a point of view and I'm not connecting emotionally with these songs, and maybe that's my fault and maybe that's Samara Joy's fault. I will say that I do like singers who, like Samara Joy, have this sort of burnished lower range, and I think they age wonderfully. Like, I love me late Ella, late Sarah. I love late Cassandra Wilson, where she's practically a bass, you know? It's like, I like those female voices that kind of have that really robust, thick, ebony tone. I don't know what to call it. I mean, they just sound amazing. There's this sort of fullness.
We may
of
well
sound.
Love mid Samara Joy. We may like late early Samara Joy. I mean, this is fucking out the gate.
I mean, yeah, she's 19. I mean, she's right.
So, 21 now, but yeah. 21. And she literally started listening to jazz at age 18. I mean, she just apparently a lot of music in her house. She said that some relative loaded up an old ancient iPod, and she just listened to it on the way to and from work, and just kind of listened to the music in the family. She wasn't like listening to radio or something. But it wasn't, she did not connect to jazz till a Sarah Vaughan performance really grabbed her. And it was late, you know, but she was surrounded by people. She was in the jazz program that had grown up and loved jazz, and they introduced her to this and that. So I wonder if a lot of this is just about literally just, she is so young, even for a 21-year-old in her experience with the music. And the great thing about her is she is not annoying. She's not doing stuff. It's like, she's not demonstrating bad taste or not, you know.
No.
So, and of course, you know, a lot of vocalists just drive me out the fucking, sometimes Cecile gets a little Broadway for my taste, you know.
Yes.
Even though, I mean, Cecile's just one of these once in a lifetime. I mean, I think Samara Joy's got a great voice. I really do.
Yes.
But I mean, it's not quite the freakishly amazing once in a generation kind of voice that Cecile's got. I mean, that's just, again, that's not going to happen probably during my lifetime again. I don't know, but you know, it is that combination, but she's got a really hugely a voice full of potential, and that she's using with great care and calmness and centeredness. It just, I agree. There's something. And I, like I said, the last time I listened to it, I'm getting a little closer to actually connecting. So I think there's something there. But I also think it's just album 5 or 6, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, I have a lot of hopes that, and I just, she's just got to find some way of finding a repertoire that says something about herself, at least one or two of the tracks that's not quite so generic. And she does a great job with it. You know, I like Stardust, but I, you know, I'm maybe not to hear it song so much. It's basically a Bix Beiderbecke tune turned into a song. But anyway.
Yeah, I, you know, hopefully, you know, it's not that I want her voice to get lower, but I do feel like certain vocalists, as they age, they get, you know, they get a lot more control over that lower range, that tone, and then they have something, you know. Certainly the singers I
really have a lot more, life experience under their belts. Yeah, there's a lot more emotional mileage traveled, so.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to future recordings by her, and I'm sure, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the voice. She's got a good voice. So maybe there'll be a little more emotional connection for me on future efforts from her. You know, who knows? We'll see. But you know, someone of promise, a lot of promise. I just didn't connect to this strongly at all.
And I feel like a lot of the reviews in their subtle way, and they tend to be 4-star, they're, you know, we're just, they'd always have some coded language that say, you know, she's really good at this, blah, blah, blah. But without maybe saying it as baldly as we have, you know, there's a little bit of an emotional reticence or just kind of a plain spokenness that doesn't quite, we don't quite, she doesn't have that emotional touch.
Well, you know why that is, Pat?
No.
It's because they're not bastards.
That's right. They're nice people and they write for a living. And so, you know, they have to not piss off everybody involved. But apparently, Whirlwind.
Since we do this for free, we can be bastards, damn it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And somebody mentioned, you know, well, on Whirlwind, the small label, because she didn't get snapped up by a major, you know, she had a little bit more control and she can make, this is a very purist album. There's no production gimmickry. There is no Eagles cover, it's just literally just slabo jazz, guitar trio. When it's everything's clicking with it, and again, I wonder if maybe just the review copy maybe had some infelicities that were ironed out before it was finally I don't know. There's some odd little moments of distortion, but overall, great sounding. And everything. All right, so what should we do next? Which instrumentalist? Mr. Young, what do you think? Is that okay? Our bassist?
Fine by me. Let's do it.
Our Canadian? Because this was, I'd say, of these albums, for me, the hardest to figure out or get a fix on. This is Dave Young, born 1940. This is apparently his 16th leader date. Kevin Turcotte on trumpet. Perry White on various reeds. Reg Schweger, I hope that's the way you say it, on guitar. Brian Dickinson on piano. Terry Clark on drums. Ewan Farcombe on organ. John Johnson on alto sax and flute, and Les Ault on flute. So a number of guests, and the organ pops up several times. It's not one of those albums where you have a set cast of characters and they work through the repertoire. It's kind of a rotating cast album. And some fine bass solos from Mr. Young. What brought this one to your attention?
Just that it was, like I said, it was one of those review copies we got last year, and I was, working my way through the backlog, and, some things, there's plenty of things I hear and I'm like, oh, that reminds me of that, and I didn't care for that, or, oh, that's interesting, blah, blah, blah. And then now and again, I'll hear something and I'll go, oh my goodness, that seems kind of fresh. That seems kind of interesting to me. And, so that's what brought this to my attention. When I heard it and listened to it, I thought, well, this is pretty good. I like this. It was that simple.
All right. But I like it too. I mean, it's, I guess it's hard for me to pin down as to what it's about. I mean, it is very mainstream. It starts off, my heart was a little bit broken because he does a Woody Shaw cover and that almost never happens. And I think Woody Shaw is a really interesting composer. But he does a Green Street Caper, which is basically on Green Dolphin Street with a slightly different riff melody instead of the original. Couldn't you have done, Katrina Ballerina or one of those songs off Unity or, so Rosewood maybe, I mean, just it's kind of a gig. Couldn't you call it a gig because everybody knows those chord changes kind of thing? Any particular performances stand out or ones that you'd recommend?
Well, for me, what was so appealing about this was, we're always complaining about not being able to hear the bass. And even without the big boy headphones, I sometimes feel like the only way bass players get the love they deserve is to headline the date. And then it's like the engineer's like, okay, we'll turn up the meter, it's your date, since the album is named for you. It's like suddenly everyone, you give some to the bass player. You can hear him and he sounds wonderful. He's got this really round, woody tone. I mean, I could just bathe in this bass playing all day long. I just love it. And I was hooked from the first number, Green Street Caper, that sort of pseudo bossa, however you want to put it, that beat. And, you can hear him right in your ears, right from the start. So for me, the whole album, I'm just listening to him. I mean, I know there's an organ player, but I tend to forget. I'm just listening for Dave. And he bows some solos, always like the bowed solo, especially when they're pretty good. And Dave's bowed solos are solid, you know? So, yeah, he sounds great. And I could just listen to him. I mean, he's what I'm listening to. Here's how you know you've got a good bass player album. When they play Monk's Evidence and you're listening to the bass player, that's when you've got a good album for the bass player. Because that's one of those tunes where you're going to be listening for the front line, you're going to be listening for the piano, and the whole time I'm just listening to him, that busy walking line that he has all the way through. It's fantastic. So I think he sounds great. Correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, bass players don't age this well. The dude's 82. He's in his 80s. And
yeah, right.
He's playing this well? Holy shit. I mean, you know, again, we talk about this when we talk about Charles McPherson. Just need to stop talking about the age. I don't care how old he is. This is great bass playing. You know, if a 20-year-old was doing this, we would say they were a monster. So I just, all the way through, I'm listening to that fat, round, really, really woody tone all the way through. Just, I can't get enough of it. I love the Horace Silver cover. I don't think that's Opus a frequent.
Funk, yeah.
You don't hear that cover very often. That's kind of going deep into the bag. And he gets a really nice, you know, featured, you know, moment on that. I think this is a terrific album. I mean, the other people on it are fine. No disrespect to any of them, but I'm just not paying attention to them. The whole album, I'm really kind of focusing in on Dave Young's bass, and I think he's fantastic. And I just kind of wonder what other stuff has there been out there that I heard with him on it? Cause I'm sure a career song as his, you know, he's played with a bunch of, you know, big names. I must have heard him before. I think he's fantastic. And, again, 82 years old and still banging stuff like this. Wow. Give the man some love. I think this is a terrific album. The side players are fine in the sense that like nothing bugged me. Like I didn't listen to this and go, oh God, that trumpet player again. Like that never happened, right?
Yeah, yeah. They're all right.
I feel like the side guys are all, you know, they do their parts well and they're enjoyable. Who's the trumpet player again? Because I kind of like some of the riffs he gets off. And we should
Kevin Turcotte, T-U-R-C-O-T-T-E, Turcotte.
Yeah, kind of dug him. Piano player, solid. Enjoy him. I liked the piano playing on the final cut, Miyako's Waltz. I thought that was nice. There's a violin on that as well, or some kind of
I don't see something. Him in the lineup there, but there must have been. Yeah, unless
or
it,
is that
I don't
a,
think
is
it was
that,
him.
No, it's not a violin. It's an alto. It's got to be an alto. It just sounds so high pitched.
Okay.
So anyway, yeah, I like Dave Young a lot. I think he's got a great tone, and he bows some solos. Always a good day when someone goes arco and they hold your attention.
Well, if it works out. I was going to say sometimes, and yeah.
If it holds your attention.
Sometimes it's a very bad day, yes. The intonation goes wrong, but he's fine, yeah.
He's fine. Who's the other great arco bassist? Paul Chambers?
He does it, yeah. Rarely is it
Oscar Pettiford. I can't remember which.
I mean, bass some will player. Do it. I mean, probably Dick Davis does some, I'm assuming.
I would assume so.
Yeah, it's just it's problematic in most jazz contexts because it's the intonation has to be all over the map, and you know, it's just not a skill that the jazz bassists work on much, right? It's more of a classical thing, and unless they're really good at it, they're doing something much more difficult than most classical players are on the bowed bass, which is, you know, going all over the instrument and also with, you know, created on the fly lines rather than something written out that you can practice over and over again. So it can be stressful. But yeah, I think maybe my issue was that you were able to listen from the bottom up here. And just in the context where I gave this album a spin most of the time, I was not able to crank it enough that I could concentrate on Dave. And certainly when I was driving this weekend, yeah, this shitty sound system in the Chevy, you just couldn't follow him. And so what I was left with was the top layers, and they're fine, but there just isn't, to me, this is very much like a standard, played at a very high level, but a club set list kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, they're not trying to create a story, not trying to present an aesthetic. And he's, you know, it says himself on the notes to accompany the album, the promo stuff, that he likes things simple. He likes them straightforward. He thinks it's important not to have too fancy chord changes because that slows down the improvisational flow. And I think that is, it's always a question with this stuff, is that you can be too simple and the musicians start to get bored or get stuck or not know what to do. Or you can be so complicated, like, you know, sometimes, say, some of Steve Coleman's work or whatever, where the horn players are playing at such a high level, they make it. They don't make mistakes. It's amazing they got through that harmonic thicket, but they seem a little bit constrained in their expression because just surviving those harmonies is about the most you can hope for unless you're a stone genius having a good day, right? It's, you know, you're just trying to make them because they're so tough. And so, yeah, somewhere in that middle is where the best soloing tends to happen, where it's not boring to them, but it's not so intimidating that they can't quite, you know, that they're kind of thinking every minute about how am I going to get to the next harmony here, change scales in time, and, you know, it's interrupting their melodic thinking. So, yeah, that level to me, this is not a super compelling record just because, you know, there's a Monk tune, you know, there's, you know, and there are some originals. I mean, I think they're fine. I don't know that any of them quite stuck with me. I mean, Mikio's waltz, I keep thinking, that's got to be Wayne Shorter, right? But it's not, you know, it's the title reminds me of one of his titles, but it's just not. But yeah, his playing is great and he's got good tone. And obviously, you know, he's still going strong in 82. So yeah, it didn't grab me the way it grabbed you, but I think again, partially it was, I just wasn't listening. A lot of listening at work has been extremely crazy. You know, sometimes I'm sitting there reading a novel. Sometimes it's balls to the wall every minute. And it's been the latter recently. And then, yeah, my other chances to listen to it just weren't the right circumstances. I should give the album a listen and just listen to the bass. Cause when I do, I enjoy it. I mean, I think he's a fine bass player. I enjoy what he's doing. It's just, I don't know that I found the tune lineup that compelling, and I think all the musicians are fine, but just nothing happened that really kind of stuck with me.
Yeah, like I said, in plowing through backlog of review albums, it's like every fifth or sixth one, something really grabs me. And that was one. I was just like, man, this is in the pocket. I enjoy this. And listen to that bass. I just was like, and then I was like, oh, of course, it's the bass player's date. No wonder I can hear him.
There you go. Yeah.
And then I, you know, found out 82, and I'm like, seriously? Holy shit. But still, I mean, if he was 22, he's rock solid.
Well, right,
he's
yeah, really I mean, good, not, so. Yeah, we're not giving him, it's just impressive that he's still playing at that level, yep, at that age.
All right.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about exorcisms.
Asafuria. So,
you know, I tried to watch The Exorcist, and I just realized, oh, this is going to get really unpleasant, and I don't want to watch this. You know,
The Exorcist is a strangely, the people who watch it, they remember one scene, and what's so important about The Exorcist is the first hour, the buildup is impeccable.
Yeah.
I mean,
it is,
it's the a tension is unbearable. Yeah, I mean, William Friedkin was touched by God when he made that movie. And people only remember the fucking pea soup. But hey, it's the first hour that will keep you having nightmares. You know, not the stuff that happens at the end, but that stuff's good anyway. So yeah, this one, I clicked instantly. Like when I, you know, started listening to this, I'm like, oh yes, this touched all my happy places right from the get-go. And I didn't look anything up about him until a few minutes before the podcast. And then when I did, I was like, Of course. So this album was recorded in 2019, didn't get released until last year because of the pandemic and stuff. But Uriah has been around for a while. He's not a kid. He's in his 30s, late 30s. But he's been in New York for a while. He's an Israeli, but he's been in New York.
Born 85. He's born 1985. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah.
So he's been here for a while. I was reading his bio, and he enrolled in the New School, and he came under the influence of Billy Harper. And I'm like, that's why. And that is the instant connect that I had. I didn't know it until I read that. And then I was like, of course. He has that sort of, he's in the Coltrane School as affiliated down through Billy Harper, that kind of dry, urgent tenor playing. And you hear it on the first number and all the way through. And that is a tenor sound I just love. I kind of feel like Billy Harper, he's in the Coltrane School, but without the constant urgent questioning effort to bash your head through that wall. Like Harper's like, life is good on this side of the wall, and I'm gonna play the fuck out of my horn over here. I don't have to touch God. Like, I can touch God without going through the wall.
It's comfortable and the modal in him. It's just it satisfies him. Yep. He's not trying to escape it. He's just here I am.
Yeah. And Harper is just one of my all time favorite saxophone players. I can't get enough of him. And so yeah, Uriah is in that bag, and he has the same kind of tone. The difference here maybe on this album would be the instrumentation. I think this is a sextet. We have a trombone. We've got a number of players here. We should say who everyone is. Josh Evans on trumpet. I feel like I've seen him live somewhere, maybe in Marsalis's Lincoln City Orchestra, Lincoln Center Orchestra or something. I feel like I've seen Josh Evans live somewhere. Jonathan, I'm going to mispronounce his name, Voltsock on trombone. And I think he's quite good. Jeremy Manasia on piano. Ben, I'm going to mispronounce his name. I'm going to go for Miners or Mainers, M-E-I-G-N-E-R-S on bass, and Jason Brown on drums. All the players are fine here on this sextet. I do think the trombone player, Voltsock is pretty compelling on a number of the songs here. And I like Josh Evans. If he's the player I'm thinking of that I've seen live. Anyway, even if he isn't, I like the trumpet playing on this album. But yeah, it's Uriah's tone. I love his playing. I just love it. This just felt like a really, like, maybe it's too comfortable. You know, maybe it's just too familiar to me from Billy Harper's music, but I like this sound a lot. I kind of locked in on it real fast and just found this really pleasant. This kind of scratched lots of itches for me. I don't think it's like, you know, I don't think it scrapes the heights of greatness. I just think it's really good. I think it's like in that Pulse Coltrane modal bag, and it's a good example of that. I don't think it's like a 5-star album. Not even sure it's a 4-star album. It's like a 3.5-star album. But man, it's good. I mean, I just really like it. It's a good example of this kind of music. And if you like this stuff, this is going to be an album you're going to enjoy, I think. Other people might say it reminds them of too many other things. But whenever Uriah fires up that tenor, I'm like, nope, this sounds different than a lot of modal stuff. This sounds like it's got that little edge, that little bite to it that keeps it from sort of sinking into background for me. Exorcisms is another really good cut. The title cut, I think, is a good example of that. When Uriah's horn comes in, it, like, the song takes off for me. I like this a lot. I hope you liked it. I have a feeling you probably didn't care one way or the other very much.
Yeah, I'm kind of neutral. It took a long time for me to get into it, and I think some of it may be, again, the circumstances where I really need these albums, this and The Young, both just needed to be full listening level to get me focused on them. They were not working as some albums I'll put in the background, and all of a sudden my ears will perk up, and I'll say, what was that? And they'll draw me in. Neither of these did that. I really had to, like, crank them, focus, and then I found lots of good things. And of the two, I think Dave's was at least more immediately engineered, where this one, I don't know, I just felt like it sounded fine. I mean, it didn't sound bad, but it seemed like it was not crisp or not, I just didn't draw my attention much. The lineup with the trumpet, trombone, and tenor sax, and the format to some degree, seven songs, and it reminded me a bit of Joe Henderson's album. Not that he sounds that much like Joe Henderson, but Mode for Joe. Which is, one of the Blue Note albums he did, mm-hmm. The only one he did with that larger ensemble. And I felt like I heard him play at least one Joe lick at one point. I'm not saying this guy is like imitating Joe Henderson, just I think he's aware of that legacy. And I guess I was trying to put it into the more the Blue Note box than the modal Billy Harper box. And yeah, I mean, the tunes seemed fine, but they didn't really stick with me. The soloing was all good, but it seemed somehow muted or muffled to me. And I can't really explain it, and I don't know. Again, I didn't have a lot of opportunities to sit down and just really crank it. And it wasn't so much the fanciness of the equipment necessary, something more just, it was a bad 2 weeks at work. And that's where I do a lot of my listening for the podcast. Just in terms of something going on all the time, having to concentrate all the time. So everything shoved way in the background. And as I said, I made a point of putting them on the car and listening to them as we drove. We did a circle around Indianapolis looking at historic homes outside of the city. And I'll talk a little bit more about one of those experiences in a minute. And the car was just not up to, it was just too muted. But I felt like that was where I was getting a breakthrough, where I really just listened to nothing but that record. And it's like, okay, I'm starting to get these songs a little bit in my bones. I'm starting to hear more individual moments. It just, for me, was a very homogenized thing until I really bore down. And then I think it's good. I mean, it was hard for me. Nothing grabbed me at first. I just didn't have that into the music that you did. Nothing about his playing, nothing about the songs. It was a very slow burn. But, at the end it's like, well, this is kind of 2022, not quite Blue Note, but that idea of acoustic sextet, playing songs of that 6 to 7 to 8 minute range. Kind of a post-bop idiom. It's one of those. And, very, again, mainstream. Nothing super surprising. Nothing too eccentric. Yeah, I just, something about it just didn't grab me. But the more I've listened to it, the better I've liked it. So it's the one I need to keep coming back to and thinking about. And, maybe I'll get that moment you had with it. I've been listening to Billy Harper recently. I just Dropboxed you something.
Oh, cool.
So he's on my mind. Yeah, again, not, again, nothing in the album. I said, I don't like this. This is bad. This is, nothing all like that. Just didn't grab me. So, but as I said, I'm starting to get into it just with the young. I think I just need to go through there and just listen to nothing but Dave. And that probably will give me the most pleasure from that record. And this one, again, I just, I liked it. I do think, in my defense, I feel like it could have been more vividly engineered. I don't know how else to put it. I'm not talking about special effects or weird stuff or something distorted or, this literally just, it just didn't seem quite as present and vivid as some albums in this genre do. But, that's subjective and, maybe I'll change my mind after a few more listens.
There is
All right. Well, we made it. Do you have any pop matters on your mind?
What's been coming across the transomere? Couple of, for some reason, I've picked up recently from the library a bunch of Stevie Wonder and a bunch of Neil Young. And I had a Neil Young moment, you know, a couple of years ago where I kind of went through a lot of his stuff, and I'm having another one of those. So I got three things to mention. The albums of Neil Young's that I picked up were something called Homegrown, which came out around the time of Tonight's the Night. At the time, he had broken up with someone, and he said the music was too personal to release. And so,
oh, right. So this is the one that it came out recently, but it was recorded back. Yes, okay.
Yes, but
I read about it. Haven't heard it yet.
There's songs on it that everyone knows because they appear on, you know, on Harvest and his other collections, right? Okay. So the songs that everyone would know would be, let's see, Love is a Rose, Star of Bethlehem, they're both on that album. They got their kind of workouts there. The other albums I've picked up by him are live albums. And I've been reading about Neil Young as a guitarist on guitar websites because a lot of people basically say he's not what you would consider a classic rock guitarist. And yet what he does is kind of really hard to do. Like he's apparently profoundly inimitable in his own weird way. He's got his own kind of approach. So one of the albums I picked up, it's a couple discs that I think called Tonight's the Night Live at the Roxy. And my God, the band that night, it was playing with Crazy Horse. Holy shit, they are on fire. They're having a really good night, and it's good to listen to. You're kind of like, holy shit, this stuff sounds better live even than it did on the albums. It's just a really good, you know, live night from him. And there's another one that I have that I just picked up called Songs for Judy. And it starts with him sort of having this, it's an acoustic set by him. And it's put together by some people who followed him on a tour where he would do like an hour acoustic set solo on guitar or piano. And then there would be an intermission. He'd come back with Crazy Horse and blow the roof off the dump. And one of the guys, I think, who helped put this together was Cameron Crowe, the guy who wrote for Rolling Stone when he was 17 and stuff. So Cameron Crowe was like a groupie on the tour with a guy who was, I think, following the band as well in a semi-official capacity. And they basically have a bunch of, you know, cassette tapes. And then when the tour was over, they decided we're going to compile a best album of the best performances of songs, you know. So it's cobbled together 14, I guess it's more than that, 23 songs of Neil acoustic. Some of them he only did once. Some of them he did 15 times on the tour. And they argued over what was the best take, you know, to get this. And it opens with, the reason it's called Songs for Judy is, you know, he's kind of high at the beginning, and he's talking about how when the set started, he looked down in the pit in front of the stage, and he saw Judy Garland, and she was talking to him, you know. And so the whole album is called Songs for Judy for that reason. It's not Judy Collins. It's Judy Garland.
I would have assumed. Yeah, I would have assumed. Okay.
And man, is it good. I mean, it's fantastic. And it was on that tour that he debuted songs like Campaigner. And, you know, that's when even Richard Nixon's got a soul, you know.
Right.
And yeah, and he also debuted, I think, Pocahontas on that tour. And it's kind of fascinating to hear audiences hear these songs for the very first time. Songs that are just sort of, you know, stone cold, the old young classics. And yeah, he's a really good vocalist, and it's an interesting collection of songs. So, those are fun. I just started getting into Stevie Wonder. And so the only one that's really kind of processed for me at this point is Talking Book. My God, that's a great album. I mean, you must adore that album.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That may be my favorite of them. In fact, I'm on.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I was in the car the other day and Superstition came on, and I was like, I could listen to this song for the rest of my life. This song is just the coolest song ever. Like that opening riff. I'm like, let's just listen to this. Can that be the soundtrack for my life from now on? I mean, I could just, I love that. It's such a good album.
I got a plump for, I love Stevie, but it's Inner Visions. That's the one that I think is, for me, of all those, partially because it's got Don't You Worry About a Thing, which I realize is just one of the all-time brilliant songs ever. I mean, I like them both a lot. I mean, Stevie, the main thing is it's like sometimes like, I wish you had a bass player, but yeah. He's a funky dude, but no one is above having a bass player is my theory.
And then here's one you can talk about. Had never gotten it before, but picked up a copy of Tango in the Night. Did you ever listen to that album?
The Fleetwood Mac?
Yeah.
It was
when we were in college. I mean, it was everywhere.
Yeah. Tell Me Lies, et cetera, yeah.
Yeah, it's Little Lies. And then
there we
go. The other song on there is, Everywhere, and then Big Love.
Yeah.
And it's much better than I thought it was going to be. I knew the singles, you know, from my misspent youth, but I hadn't listened past the singles anywhere on that album. And it's, you know, it's clearly a Buckingham-driven affair. Like, he's producing the whole thing. And apparently he had songs for another solo album, and the band were like, nope, those are ours now. And he's like, okay. And, they kind of fit. Apparently, in the making of the album, Stevie Nicks was basically strung out on drugs and therapy from her breakup with Buckingham. And also, it was problematic because they were recording the album basically in Lindsey Buckingham's bedroom, and he brought his new girlfriend to all of the recording sessions. So Stevie Nicks basically skipped most of the recording of the album. They got her in studio for a couple of songs. And so she's kind of not actually on the album. And some of the things that you think are her are not. It's actually Lindsey Buckingham's vocals speeded up.
Oh, so okay.
On Big Love, I don't know if you remember Big Love, there's this sort of...
They love that stuff, yeah. He's really into those little samples. That's a distinctive twitch on that album, right, that he puts
in. So, all of the samples where you think it's her, it's actually Lindsey Buckingham's voice speeded up because Stevie was not there.
Wow, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
I got that a while back.
You find out when you read the liner notes. I was like, wow, I didn't know this in 1987, and I know it now. So
I always thought, Christine McVie was a secret weapon.
She was. She's like... She was the secret weapon of all of their best albums. But yes, good stuff. Good.
When marimba rhythms start to play, dance with me, make me sway. Like the lazy ocean hugs the shore, hold me close, sway me more. Like a flower bending in the breeze, bend with me, sway with ease. When we dance, you have a way with me.
But yeah, I love that stuff. So I don't have a lot to report on. One album and then a weird experience I had with a cult. So I got a Billy, I'm sending it to you. This is not the Pop Matters album, but Billy Harper Live at Antibes, or just Antibes 75. It's
nice.
A two-song album. That's, I think, Sam Records released, it's only available on LP, blah, blah, blah. It's a pretty decent sound. I think French radio recorded it, and it's like Croquet Ballet and A Cry of Hunger or something, just two songs. But it's just, kind of Billy from that era, and I think you'll enjoy it. And then that was for sale. So apparently, Billy's always had a little bit lower name recognition than probably he deserves, right? He's just not as well-known a figure as he should be. And the other thing I got on sale, almost half price, was, have you ever heard A Touch of Tabasco by Rosemary Clooney?
No.
It is a Latin American album made for RCA by her at the height of her first burst of popularity. And she was married to Jose Ferrara, is that how you say it? Famous actor, and then had a whole bunch of kids with him, and had a nervous breakdown, all sorts of issues. But this is her, before she had the great comeback in the 70s when she started.
Oh, Jose Ferrer. I was trying to figure out what the hell you were saying. Ferrer. Yeah, okay.
Ferrer. Okay.
Ferrer, yes.
Anyway, and so he apparently taught her this idiom, and she performed in it. There's 12 songs. It is 28 and a half minutes long. And ORG and their wisdom decided to release it as a 2-album, 45 RPM. It's like,
what?
It's just insane. I mean, there's 3 songs aside. It's a 12-song album, and most of the songs are under 3 minutes. I mean, well under 3 minutes. So they could have made this a 45 RPM album just one album. I think they could have fit the whole thing on it at 45 RPM on a 12-inch. You know, I think you can fit 15 minutes, 14 minutes of music pretty easily at that speed. But for some reason, they made it double. I'm like, look, I mean, this is, it's a good album. She does a good job with it. She's got that warm, you know, if you want to talk about a good, no-nonsense singer, she's not doing a lot of really fancy things, but just delivers the music with taste and you know, some commitment, some warmth. There you go, Rosemary Clooney. You know, she's not going to bowl you over, but she doesn't put a foot wrong, and it's very entertaining. And it's, you know, hyper music with bongos and loud brass swells and everything. But what in God's name possessed them to put this on two LPs? I don't know.
Right.
It's like, okay, it's been 7 minutes. Get up. It's time to go. 7 minutes. Flip it over, you know. So anyway, that's why it was half price, because that was a stupid thing to do. And I thought, well, I've never heard this record. Normally these things sound, and it does sound great, you know, but what the fuck? So it's not quite jazz. It's more in that, I don't know, Latin American idiom that we touched on a bit a couple episodes back. The more commercial end of it, it's sonically fun. I mean, it's great bachelor pad. I mean, she's a real musician. She's got actual things to say musically, but it's not miles removed from that genre. It's very, very stereo. But wow, you wonder, it's like these little companies, they tend to do the same things over and over again. And the old war horse is like, there's another version of Kind of Blue or whatever, fine. But was anybody asking for a super audiophile version of Touch of Tabasco? I don't know. Apparently not many people, because no one bought it. And so I just want to close with this experience I had. So Joyce and I read this article about a year ago of like historic homes an hour and a half or less from Indianapolis in Indiana. Fine. So we picked three to go to. We went to Kokomo, Muncie, and Columbus, and saw their featured historic homes. Muncie, Indiana, there's this family that made billions, I think it was the Ball family, jars. And so they built themselves mansions all along this river. There's like four or five. There's a museum complex next to them, and you can go and see. One of them is open to the public, a couple's owned by Ball State. And then one is devoted to that great artist, Bob Ross.
Wow.
Because Bob Ross, apparently his show, which is now famous, did you ever hear of Bob Ross or see him when he was out in the 80s and 90s?
I know. I did,
okay,
actually.
So you were at least aware of him. I mean, I feel bad because it's like the kids found him on YouTube and made a cult of him, but I never heard of him. So you at least saw him. I've got nothing against the guy. He's soothing, right? He's got amazing.
He was ASMR before ASMR was a thing. I remember watching him on PBS and feeling hypnotized by Bob in the 80s. And I will tell you that on our walks around the neighborhood, you know, there are lots of little free libraries. Because our niece is an NPR junkie, she knows who Bob Ross is, even though she's like 7 years old. And we found the Bob Ross board game in one of those little free libraries, unopened, mint condition. So we took it and sent it to the kids. We have not yet had the chance to play ourselves the Bob Ross board game, but I am assured that Harper has played the Bob Ross board game. And I have no idea what's involved in the Bob Ross board game. No matter what, it must be very chill.
I would assume. Right. I know my mom hated Mr. Rogers. We did watch him. So probably if she ever found out about it, she made sure we didn't, you know, because she did not like that kind of delivery. So we wandered in this giant museum structure that, you know, this modern place, and we have to buy tickets to go see this historic house. So I'm buying them. It's like, well, you want to go see the Bob Ross exhibit, blah, blah, blah. It's like, I just want to see that, you know, and she really gets insistent, and it's like, it's a little surreal. It's like, why do you give and so finally it's the same price and say, okay, fine. Give me tickets to the Bob Ross experience, you know, that fine. And so we look at, there's like a juried art exhibit upstairs, which is not Bob Ross thing. It's fine. And we wander down this historic house. It's a beautiful, it's of the three, the only one I'd ever want to live in. And the downstairs has some of the furniture left over. These people collected children's books. It's just awesome. Great wood and everything. And then upstairs, there's no furniture. They've removed some of the walls and it's kind of become a gallery space. And the whole thing is devoted to like 18-inch square quilts honoring, celebrating, and imitating Bob Ross. Dozens of them. And this is where you start to wonder, did the car go off the road? And is this what's, I'm experiencing as I die? Is it, am I dreaming? Did I not get out of bed yet? You know, what is this over? And it's quilt after quilt after quilt. Pictures of him, sayings by him, happy little trees. Just how many people make these things? So then we go down, there's this little pimply youth who's kind of the guy running, he's the employee there. And, he talks, it was great. You've got to go see the Bob Ross Experience. I'm like, I see you've bought tickets for it. I'm like, yeah, I'm nodding. He's like, I'm not going to that fucking place. This is so creepy. And I told him, and it's like, well, I grew up during this era and I never heard of the guy. And he looks at me and he's either the best acting hipster in the world or just was, I think he just meant it. He's like, some people just take a while to be discovered. Some artists, it just takes a while. It's like, yeah, that's true of Van Gogh, you little shit. It's got nothing to do with Bob Ross. What are you talking? Wow. Are you fucking hypnotized? Did they put a chip in your head? Anyway, the whole thing was fucking scary. I did not like it. And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 238. As always, you can reach us at mike@jazzbastard.com or pat@jazzbastard.com. You can drop me a line on our Facebook page, or if you like, look me up on All About Jazz. You can stream the podcast from All About Jazz, download it from www.jazzbastard.com, get it from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and you used to be able to get it from Mixcloud, but it seems like they don't like us anymore, and I apologize for that, but hopefully you're finding it somewhere. Tune in next time as we do a pianist-focused episode, looking at three pianist-led dates and then one trio led by a bassist. We're going to look at works by artists as diverse as Lenny Tristano, Billy Lester, Deanna Witkowski, and Robert Acipinti. Until next time, take care.